This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
Growing up in the woods of rural Oregon, Carl Wieman spent time alone, pursuing interests that might have led him to a career as a writer or a professional chess player. But as an undergraduate at MIT, he discovered his lifelong love of building things, answering real questions, and solving problems in the laboratory. When color-adjustable lasers became available, Wieman envisioned the advances these less complicated and less expensive lasers could facilitate in physics, and he used the new lasers to study parity violation in atoms. This work eventually led to the 2001 Nobel Prize in Physics for the achievement of Bose-Einstein condensation in dilute gases of alkali atoms, and for early fundamental studies of the properties of the condensates. Wieman is a distinguished professor of physics at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics, JILA, at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1995.
Like many physicists I've talked to, you seem to have been, as a child, someone who liked tinkering and building things.
Yeah, I sort of got naturally into that. It's probably helped by, we live way out in the woods, and so people were just naturally a little more self-reliant. You couldn't run to the store anytime right. You wanted something, so it was kind of the way of life a bit.
That was Oregon?
Yeah.
And you spent your whole childhood there?
Up until high school, we lived way out in the woods. Father worked in the lumber industry until when I went to high school. Then my parents moved actually into Corvallis, which was for us the big city of, 20,000 or something, but it was better school for me and my siblings, so.
It seems like you're the result of good schooling, public library, and parents who really cared about where you went to school and your education.
Yeah, I'm not sure the schooling had such a big impact, to be honest. But yeah, my family, education was kind of always considered important.
And you spent time at the public library, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, I do much of my early childhood was spent in the public library and coming back with giant piles of books and reading them for the next week's trip into town. So,
were you aware of physics back then, or did you take anything early on?
Not really. I mean, my sort of earliest awareness of anything remotely close to it was being interested in math, but I was interested in reading and everything else too. So it was probably, I guess it was in seventh grade where I had a teacher, actually, in chemistry, but at that point I wasn't making fine distinctions, who was, talking about how atoms behaved, why certain atoms would stick together and make molecules and others wouldn't. And I remember being struck by him and impressed by the subject then.
You were also very interested in athletics, weren't you? And chess?
Well, I mean, I was obsessed. Everything I got involved with was done fairly obsessively. So, there was the chess phase and then the tennis phase. And then once my elbows from practicing too much, then there was the physics stage.
Well, I guess chess is sort of a kind of mathematical.
I'm not sure. I guess I don't think of it as so much mathematical. There's patterns, though. You sort of look at the big patterns and try and see subtleties in them, which is, I think, probably the only real sort of intellectual benefit I could see from that.
And sharpening your powers of concentration.
Yeah, absolutely. You really do have to learn to concentrate very carefully and focused on that. And I think that that probably was clearly beneficial.
So you had this class in chemistry that got you interested in science, but where did you first come up on physics?
Well, I mean, that was physics. I mean, there are electrons and atoms, and they stick together. But then I remember more sort of in the following year having a physical sciences course where I first learned about the ideas of light and how it atoms respond to it. I remember doing a project on that I was interested in.
You ended up going to MIT, so you must have had some background. I mean, to get in there.
I've kind of wondered about, getting into MIT, I'm sure in retrospect, now that I know about college admissions and so on, it wasn't like I had spectacular grades. I was reasonably high, but there were clearly people, significant number of people higher than me in a small high school in Oregon. And, I'm sure that it appealed to them that I was, a reasonably good high school tennis player and quite a good, well-known chess player at that point. But, in retrospect, I'm sure what really appealed to them is I came from the woods of Oregon, and they're looking for diversity. So now that I know that at the time I was clueless, that was an issue. But now,
it was a gamble that paid off for them anyways. Yeah. Was, that must have been a big cultural change for you, though, going to MIT from Oregon.
Was that a dramatic, the first time I ever got on an airplane was to fly to Boston. I remember coming in sort of to the cafeteria the first or second day in the dormitory and asking people what those funny round things were with the holes in them. That was the first time in my life I'd ever seen a bagel. And all these kids from New York, they couldn't believe I was serious. Anyway, it was quite a culture shock.
The people must have been very different, too. There were all these real, probably driven.
Yeah, although that wasn't so different because I'd been partly through my chess interests. In Corvallis, I'd been sort of hanging around with the kids of university faculty who were, getting pushed real hard to go into intellectual activities. So that wasn't so different. MIT has sort of a unique culture of aggressive competitiveness in that respect, but it wasn't like that was so strange to me. At times I didn't like it.
When you got there, obviously you were an undergrad, so you took what you needed to take there, but did you have any idea what you wanted to do, or just feeling your way through?
Well, at that point I knew I was kind of interested in physics, but I wasn't that convinced that that's what I was going to do. I remember feeling that I was interested in writing, too. I thought I was pretty good at it. I enjoyed it. And I continued to read a lot of everything. So obviously, going to MIT sort of limited one's options. Probably as, without really thinking about it too much. But I remember when I was thinking that, thinking of some sort of possibly technical kind of writing things. And, if it'd been up to courses, I might have ended up doing that. But, my success in science courses is limited at best and largely non-existent because I got involved in a lab. And I did that entirely because there was one special seminar, which was kind of the high point of any courses I took at MIT, which was, just a small seminar, 10 freshmen or something, with this gruff old friendly guy, Al Hill, who I think was like the associate chair of the department. And we just sat around and talked about physics. And so he kind of encouraged me and got me involved in working in a research lab, which was Kleppner's lab. Mm-hmm. And that was, that was the defining experience. In a way, that's why I continued to not put much attention into courses, because I realized that compared to, courses just seem so artificial compared to answering real questions and trying to figure things out that people didn't already know the answers to. So once I got started in that and realized I was good at it, in part because just having a lot of persistence, being obsessively focused on it, made you successful in that. And so then that very quickly I was convinced I was going to be a physicist.
Snowballed, huh?
Yeah.
This Professor Hill, do you think he saw something in you?
Yeah, I know he did because, he just sort of pulled me aside and said, hey, you seem to have some particular interest here and we had to see if we can get you involved in a lab. And I don't remember enough about it to know why he would have picked that out, frankly. But
So you went into Dan Kleppner's lab from there. Did you start off right away on a particular problem? Did he set you on something or did you come up with?
No, I mean, he gave me, worked a whole series of problems. I remember, let's see, the first one was trying to make these very thin carbon films. And so it never worked, but they didn't know how to make it work either. So it wasn't that, you know, I tried a million different things and sort of with very limited success. And in retrospect now, it's pretty clear it was kind of a stupid project, but it got me started playing with equipment.
Didn't put you off.
Yeah, it didn't put me off. Again, but, you know, it really brought out, I guess at that time, it was already clear that just being stubborn sometimes, you know, was a good aspect in science, because it was one of these things you just had to try one thing and then didn't work, you change conditions a little bit and do that over and over and over. So,
and obviously the hands-on aspect of it appealed to you, maybe given your background.
Right, yeah, you know, you could build things, glue up little assemblies of stuff, and that was something that, of course, in courses you never run into before.
Generally, when you're put in a lab, they give you something to work on that's not known, or do they ever start you off with something to just get a taste of how things work?
Well, okay, so I've been a faculty member now for 25-some years, and I actually always have a lot of undergraduates working with me, and in part because I figure I sort of owe it. You know? And so one does it different ways, but I know now that it's much better to give them something that you're pretty certain is going to work. Building something we already know what's going to do, you know, for us it's old, but for them it's completely new experience, and actually making something on their own, checking that, figuring out, you know, works. So in fact, that's usually a much more successful way to
most
do things.
People, a payoff is nice. I mean, you're an exception, and I mean, I'm sure at MIT there might be more exceptions than at other schools, but you know, I would think a lot of undergrads would want some feeling that they figured something out.
Yeah.
So you'd had this project, and at a certain point you realized it just wasn't going to work, and then you asked him for a different one, or did you start on
No, something? I kept trying these things, and it wasn't sort of getting somewhere. And then it got to the end of the school year, I think. I'm getting kind of vague now about the details. So then there was a possibility whether I could stay and work in the labs during the summer. And so when that started, then I had a lot more time, and it was pretty clear this project just wasn't going to get anywhere. I think, I can't remember sort of whether it was me tracking down references on this or them, but some combination also said, hey, look, you know, people have already shown this isn't going to work very well. And so then I was given another problem, which is a computer calculation type thing, and then I was also kind of a guinea pig for, they were developing a textbook then, and so I would go through the galley proofs and tell them what didn't make sense to me. So,
physics book, I guess.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Introductory physics book. So.
Oh, yeah, early foray into the education end of things. So this was all during the summer, and then you must have either started yourself on something else.
So then there was this new project and sort of getting into this computation thing. And then actually what happened was I'd sort of worked through that, and the lab was looking to get into lasers, which they'd never done before. Mm-hmm. And so this is the new era of lasers where you could make adjustable colors come out, and that was much more useful for studying atoms with.
What years?
This would have been 72. So it was kind of a new technology. They wanted to sort of try and find out a little more about it. So Kleppner actually had a senior student who was going to be doing this as a senior thesis project, and I was going to be helping him. I might have been late my sophomore year. And then, so they bought some, you know, basic equipment. It wasn't a big fancy thing, but it was something to work with. And then the senior student kind of disappeared, as happens routinely in these kind of projects. So I was left with this whole lab and this whole project all by myself, which was great. And so I got to start playing with lasers and tinkering with them, and then start, you know, with Kleppner thought of ideas to try and study with them. And so, you know, as a sophomore in college, I was starting to blast atoms with lasers, and that's largely what I've been doing ever since. So, but, you know, there was a certain set of fortuitous circumstances of why I got into this and my level of independence in it.
Oh, because of the senior student leaving?
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like something that might have appealed to you immediately.
Yeah, I mean, it was an exciting new technology, and sort of looking back on my career, one of the things I think that, you know, are perhaps the only distinguishing thing, I mean, and sort of why I've been successful is, you know, any sort of usual measures of smartness. There's a lot of other people who are better. Measures of kind of obsessiveness. There aren't a lot of people better than that. But there are still a fair number of, you know, awfully obsessive, competitive people who are smarter. But that I have a knack of picking the right areas to work in. And after a while, you decide it's probably not just luck. So it's hard to pin down sort of what goes into that. But frankly, lasers was one. I mean, I very early on, and I'm sort of, you know, astonished now that here as a sophomore, junior, undergraduate, I could see, hey, these kind of lasers will let you do really neat things looking at atoms that people haven't been able to do before. You know, this is a really good thing to be working on. And, you know, that was the right answer. The point is that technology really revolutionized atomic physics, and I was right there following the crest of the wave. So,
were those decisions always conscious, you think, of choosing the right thing, or was it just sort of following intuition?
Sometimes they're, well, it depends on what you mean by conscious. I mean, yeah. I remember sitting down looking at this and thinking, this is going to be a good thing to work on because there's going to be lots of opportunities here. And, you know, throughout my career, I've made those choices
It's pretty conscious.
Pretty yeah. conscious, yeah. Okay. Sort of where will this go? I think, you know, recognition that success in science is really what other people think is good, not, you know, there's no absolutes, although, you know, scientists like to pretend there are, that there are great, important questions that are, you know, and a question's great and important just because a lot of people get together and agree that it's great and important. So I'm probably a little more thoughtful in evaluating, look, this, here's why people don't appreciate it now, but that they might appreciate it later, and therefore be successful going into that.
What was being done with lasers at that point when you got your hands on them?
Oh, so at that, I mean, you know, it really was a critical time in the technology. The laser itself was invented, I don't know, 1957 or something like that. But they always were at only very fixed colors, and those colors almost never matched the color that atoms will absorb light. And so you were enormously limited. They were neat things, but you couldn't really do very much with them. And so the lasers that I started playing with were a new type where you could adjust the color to over some reasonable range to be anything you wanted. And so if you had an atom that needed a particular color to study certain things about it, these lasers let you do it. And so those were brand new at that point. And it really is that technology of what we call tunable lasers that, like I say, took atomic physics from being kind of a backwater of physics to now, last several years, the one everybody's trying to hire more people in. So,
what sorts of things did you start off working on once you had your hands on the laser?
Blasting atoms with them, looking at how the atoms, a sample of atoms, absorbed the light and then re-emitted, how that depended on the wavelength, looking at time as a function of time when you blasted the atom, how it responded.
If you get answers to those questions, where can you take that and what questions can you fit those into to figure out?
Well, okay. I mean, you know, this was an undergraduate thesis. And so, in fact, I observed things that I never could explain and didn't make too much sense to me. And in retrospect, in fact, you know, the phenomena I was observing 3 or 4 years later, I remember in the middle of graduate school, this whole series of papers coming out, basically showing my observations and showing how they demonstrated a kind of neat phenomena that people hadn't appreciated before. But that was way beyond kind of my theoretical understanding or hope of getting theoretical understanding at that point to make sense of it. But as soon as I saw these other papers, I was, hey, that was my stuff in my undergraduate thesis. I couldn't explain. Darn.
So what were the phenomena?
It's not really that interesting. It's that if you've got a dense sample of gas and you shine a very strong pulse of light that's right at the peak color for atoms to absorb, and then you wait with time and you see the atoms absorb the light and then they spit it back out. And what I saw was that there was both a very fast component spitting out and then a slower, then over longer time. And depending on how you change the color of the light to be right where the atoms peak was versus a little ways off, you got more and more of this fast stuff coming out and less of the slow stuff. It's now well understood, and that's how atoms respond to light. But at that time, it was actually not.
Did it have any relevance to your research that came after that, or did it just work on at that point?
It was just a side project. And like I say, I went away kind of, baffled as to what was going on and figured it was probably some funny thing and the experiment wasn't done right. And it turns out, like I say, it wasn't, but it could have been my first paper, what can I say?
After completing your undergraduate studies, you went to Stanford.
How did you decide on Stanford?
I decided on Stanford because it was as different from MIT as I could find. It was on the other coast. It was warm and miserably cold. It wasn't hot and muggy in the summers. And MIT does have this culture of sort of, it's probably still the same as an undergraduate particularly, a sort of kind of very competitive one-upsmanship. People were much more concerned about kind of showing they were better than someone else rather than actually accomplishing anything of substance.
Status.
So, yeah. So, I wasn't crazy about that. So Stanford seemed, the graduate program seemed kind of much more relaxed, laid back. So I remember looking at both Berkeley and Stanford, and Berkeley seemed to be kind of more competitive, and so I went to Stanford instead. Now, in fact, after a couple of years, I started finding myself feeling like, gee, I wish these people were a little more intense about, what they're doing. So
it's interesting, a lot of the atomic laser-type people ended up at Stanford, though, didn't they? I mean, Steve Chu and...
Yeah, and it's not an accident. It all has to do with the same technology. I mean, one of the attractions to me to Stanford was that there was this person, Ted Hinch, there, who really made a major advance in this tunable laser technology. And I remember as an undergraduate reading his papers thinking, boy, this is going to be great to have a laser like this. And so that had a lot to do with actually my going to Stanford. When I went there, I didn't want to commit to definitely staying and doing the same thing, working with them, but I knew that was a strong possibility and that I wanted to look, so I spent a year sort of looking around, but then I hadn't worked with them. And so, Hinch was there and did all this stuff, and then Chu went there. There's lots of people who use lasers for lots of things.
A lot of laser people,
so.
Yeah. But there was inventor of the laser.
Art Schaller was there first, yeah. And Hinch came to work with him.
So you were over at Stanford after, once you got there.
Yeah.
What sorts of problems you started on now that you had this new improved technology?
So then started a general trend of my career of kind of looking at what you could do with atoms, but not just for the atom's sake, but kind of trying to look at bigger physics questions using the fact that you now had this technology, you could measure things about atoms exquisitely well, and look at behavior, and so that you could then use that behavior to ask, what can that tell you about broader areas of physics? And so I started looking at something called the Lamb shift in hydrogen, and that's really testing our basic understanding of electromagnetism. I mean, that's quantum electrodynamics, and it sort of was it wasn't a novel test, but it was a little different test than anybody had been able to do before, and certainly sort of with the first kind of laser-based test of really quantum electrodynamics and pushing in a slightly different direction.
Because you're going into elementary particle physics.
Yes, yeah. And so, yeah, and I spent a lot of time pushing laser technology, pushing experimental techniques in order to measure this more carefully.
Were you interested in the particle physics also? Did you talk to the people in those areas?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I was interested in this because it was more than just looking at how atoms behave. There were sort of bigger issues involved. And
a reason for the behavior or a use for the behavior.
Yeah, and sort of testing different aspects of physics that hadn't been tested. And yes, I did talk to the people about that. In fact, one of my graduate school housemates is turns out to be one of the leaders in the area. So it was particularly helpful working with him. Peter Lepage.
Did you get ideas from speaking with these people?
No, it was really, I mean, the ideas were laid out well before me. Just, you know, this was a contribution to the splitting between two energy levels in an atom, and if you could measure that splitting really, really well, you could then determine this particular contribution better, and this contribution was a test of a sort of deeper level test of this basic quantum electrodynamics. And so spent a lot of time talking to Peter to understand that test, yeah. and other theorists, and trying, you know, getting from them what the implications would be of measuring to a certain level.
So you got to put your work into a context then, which was probably like having a secondary sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, that made the work much more significant, that it wasn't just being limited. And, you know, if you look at all my kind of subsequent work, it has that same flavor to it. You know, it's kind of taking the technology we've got of atoms and lasers and seeing, you know, what kind of bigger questions, more, to me, more interesting things you can explore with it.
Did you proceed from that point while you were working on that, with that in the back of your mind, that you wanted to be working on things that had this sort of payoff in a grander scale?
Yeah. And I, in fact, had looked, when I first went to Stanford, I'd looked into going into elementary particle physics and decided not to, for a couple reasons. One is I didn't like sort of the working environment, where these were now big teams of people. Your political skills mattered more than your physics ability. Mm-hmm. And I like things where, you know, you didn't get to tinker. I like things I could, like I say, going back to my childhood, I could build myself and make work, be in control of things rather than being part of a big team. And so I said, no, I don't want to do traditional elementary particle physics, even though the physics was interesting. And besides, I mean, I have sort of some deep underlying affection for light and atoms, and just kind of a, you know, that's just, there's something kind of fundamentally pleasing and interesting about how an atom responds to light, yeah, and does different things. And
it's sort of more tangible in a way, too.
Yeah, and you get to use pretty lasers, and, you know, colors are nice.
You managed to have yourself sort of a best of both worlds situation, because you did get to work,
yeah,
in particle physics in
a little bit, yeah. You know, it's always kind of on the periphery, but you know, I, over the course of my career, I've gone and given a number of invited talks at particle physics conferences. So
you're well accepted by that community then.
Well, at least known as an obscure, semi-obscure contributor who goes around saying how he can measure some of the same stuff they do at 1/100 the cost.
Did you continue in that line then? While you were at Stanford, you followed up on that work? Or?
Well, so I finished that measurement at Stanford, got my degree, and then I went to the University of Michigan, where I really then made a very active decision to apply the same concept of, okay, look what we can do measuring atoms with light very precisely, what can we look at? And at that point, there was this idea of parity violation in atoms.
It's a handedness thing?
Okay, it's a handedness thing, and this was back with Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow unifying the electromagnetic and weak interactions, saying there's this theory that explains all of it. And then people, particularly the Bouchias, realized that if that was true, it means that parity violation, instead of just being with neutrinos, there should be a little tiny effects in atoms. And so if you could measure those, you could really test this theory. And so at that point, it really was very competitive with what they were trying to do in elementary particle physics of testing this theory. And so, you know, this had all the right ingredients for me, and so I jumped into pursuing that.
Is parity violation sort of like things are not equal on both sides?
Parity violation in an atom just means that if you look at a mere reflection of an atom, it doesn't look exactly the same. So I tend to think of it when I present my general talk on this. I draw the atom with a little tiny hand on it. And so if you look in a mirror, it goes from right-hand to left-handed. So it looks different. And so that it has this little tiny amount of handedness, although it's really, really tiny. You know, the main thing is this symmetric structure that you look in a mirror looks just the same.
So the symmetry is a little off.
Yeah, the symmetry is off by just this incredibly tiny amount. But if you measure that well, it has tremendous implications.
The work with the lasers, what did that allow you to do with handedness?
Yeah, so it turns out that this handedness of an atom means that there are transitions between certain energy levels in the atom which are absolutely forbidden. You can never make, you know, its electrons to rearrange to go from this state to this state if they have this parity symmetry. And so now if you break that symmetry a little bit, it allows them to go a little bit from this state to this state. So if you have a laser that's just at the right color to drive that transition and you blast them really hard and you look really carefully, you can see that very occasionally an atom will make that transition. And by looking at how often it makes that transition, you can tell how much this symmetry is broken.
There's a relationship between
them. So there's a direct relationship between the strength of certain atomic transitions and the distortion that you want to measure.
You can kind of graph that out, I guess? And is this something that was known before, or is this something that you showed?
So this was something that it just was, I mean, it was very new idea, but it was shown before. I mean, I'm honest enough to admit that just about everything that I've done, the big ideas come from other people. What I'm good at is taking people's, you know, big ideas and figuring out how to do the experiments to actually realize them. And so that's what I did in this case was, you know, it was an exciting idea. A bunch of people were trying to figure out how to do experiments that could actually measure it. And so I started working on that and over the years figured out better ways to measure it and did. So if it turned out a little differently, I could have got a Nobel Prize for that, but it turned out to be exactly what everybody had predicted. And so that meant there wasn't, you know, new revolutionary discovery.
But you did show experimentally that it was.
Yeah. So we showed pretty, I mean, the first crude experiments, there were several groups that started way before I had got into this. And there were some troubles at Michigan where I went that things not working out there the way I planned, and that sort of delayed my career for a while. But then I, you know, got seriously involved in this, and there were a few groups who came out with sort of very crude measurements, but strongly suggesting that there was this parity violation. But then sort of over the next 15 years, I mean, this was a long, hard experiment. Then we just kept improving and improving, to be frank, way beyond what anybody else has done in this. And so our measurements actually are reasonably significant for constraining a lot of the elementary particle physics possibilities that people have proposed.
Sometimes things are posited, say the quark, and they get the Nobel for that. But then when people find it, they also...
You know, usually, yeah, it depends on the level of, and, you know, that's the place where probably politics comes in. Yeah. But, you know, I don't bear any grudges. Yes. I mean, you know, it turned out to confirm what people thought, and there were other experiments from high energy physics, which had already kind of made pretty clear basic ideas were right. And it could have been, you know, we tested certain things they couldn't test. And it could, you know, nature could have worked out that there were some things there, but there weren't. And so that's life, you know.
By then, were you at Colorado? Or?
Yeah. So I started those experiments at Michigan, spent a few years there, made enough progress to get a job somewhere else and left as soon as I could.
Happily left.
Yeah.
And set up a new lab and everything, I guess. Right, did you bring your students with you?
Yeah. So we packed the lab and all the students and all the students' possessions in a moving van and drove out to Colorado and started over.
And finished that work up there.
Yeah, but that took, even then, I mean, we had a series of improved experiments, but that experiment was a... least 15-year effort from beginning to end, which is a very long atomic physics experiment.
So from there, did you go to the Bose-Einstein condensator?
Well, actually, it was a spin-off, because for the last generation of these parity violation experiments, we figured we could do things, we knew how to do things better. It was going to take 4 lasers, and at that time, the kind of lasers were running about $250,000 each, and even if I could have gotten the money for them, which is dubious or out of the question.
Unlikely.
The scale of atomic physics experiments,
it's
just
like the
too expensive.
Super collider.
Yeah.
University.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I couldn't even fit them on a table. So I started exploring alternative technologies, and so started playing with these diode lasers, the kinds that are in CD players and laser pointers, and trying to see if you could change those to get them to work in such a way you could control the light, color the light coming out of them well enough to replace these really expensive lasers. And so after a couple of years of playing around with that, we made a lot of progress and we succeeded. But then we were looking at, you know, both I and the graduate student were very conscious of of the fact that, okay, he'd spent a couple of years on this, and so he now could establish that we could use these in the next generation of parity violation experiment. But each generation of a parity violation experiment was about 6 or 7 years all by itself, and he didn't want, you know, he so it was unreasonable to expect him to get through that. And so we were looking for kind of easy, fun things to do with these new kind of lasers. And again, easy, fun, and how to make an impact. I mean, you know, how to be successful. And this was, again, a very conscious decision that people had just started, you know, Philips and Chu had started doing laser cooling at that point. You know, and so that was an exciting new direction. People were, you know, it was all the buzz, the meetings about what was happening in that. And we realized, hey, you know, our cheap little lasers can do that in some ways, maybe even a little better than what they're doing with their really expensive lasers. And so we did that. You know, it was, like I say, it was almost a hobby. And its real appeal was, it's just, you know, we weren't going to do any exciting new physics. We were going to show you could do that same physics at 1/100 the cost.
Because it's almost like a fortuitous not having enough money.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really, you know, that got me into laser cooling, just to make that demonstration. But then once we saw that we did have these cold atoms, and then our lasers were pretty good. And so we could get samples that were colder, denser than other people had. And so we started I mean, it really then got me interested in the whole behavior there. And so that launched then a number of years of studying the behavior of very cold atoms, laser cooling, using laser light to hold them. That's what we call trapping. And so I was pretty much in the middle of that field then for a while, and sort of understanding more and more about how to do it, understanding what limited the temperatures. And then that's really when I thought I understood better than other people as to what limited the temperature and what you had to do to get things colder. Then that was really what launched us into seriously thinking about going after Bose-Einstein condensation. But we're talking about a five-year period there.
Was Bose-Einstein condensation something people had been actively looking for?
Bose-Einstein condensation was something. Einstein had predicted it in 1924. And back, I was still at Michigan. I remember hearing about the experiments. In fact, Kleppner was one of them who had set out to try and achieve this Bose-Einstein condensation in a gas.
I mean, so what does that mean exactly, the Bose-Einstein condensation?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. But, Einstein's basic idea was that if you take a gas of atoms and you can make it cold enough and it stays a gas, and there's all kinds of processes that try and so it wants to turn into an ice cube instead of a gas, but those are kind of turned off. And of course, Einstein was a theorist, so it's easy to turn off things. It stays a gas. If you get it cold enough, then there's this very kind of unique phase transition where all the atoms coalesce into a single quantum state. So they sort of give up their identities and become this giant quantum blob, okay? So that's a sort of simplistic view of what it is. So he predicted it in 1924 and didn't really do much else with it, and neither did anyone else. It sort of seemed they weren't at all sure that it could actually happen with real atoms, and the temperatures looked ridiculously low. And so over the decades since then people come to see the physics of superfluid helium and the physics of superconductivity are closely related to this, but they're quite different from, those are some fraction of the electrons in a solid, things like that. And so very different from Einstein's concept of a gas where the whole material goes into this. So sometime in the, late 70s, even early 80s, people started thinking about trying to actually do this in a gas. And it turns out they were inspired for all the wrong reasons. The reasons that inspired them turned out to be not correct at all. But that's a long and kind of interesting story by itself as to how, if they'd understood it better, they never would have started. But luckily they did start. And so we came along then with these laser-cooled atoms, and we had the benefit of looking at all of their, it probably was 15 years of work at that point, of all their trials and tribulations and struggles and failures, and realized that we could go with a completely different technical approach of how to achieve this that would look, a better opportunity. And, like I said before, what I'm good at is not thinking of the big ideas, thinking out how to make the experiments to get there. And that was another example.
Technology to achieve this.
Yeah, and we didn't realize that. In fact, that was impossible to know. There was details about the behavior of how atoms interacted at very low temperatures that could have just prevented it. Nature wouldn't have had any trouble at all making it never allowed to happen, that the atoms, as they got to a Bose condensation, just would have turned into a solid and disappeared from our system, and we couldn't do anything about it. And so we really couldn't know until we made it that it could exist. We sort of understood enough to know there was a potentially attractive route, but again, along a lot of the stages on there, we didn't know. We sort of had to do a lot of experiments that, if nature was very kind, they would have worked and we would have got Bose-Einstein condensation. But nature wasn't so kind, and we always had to be very careful to design it so that Eva Nature wasn't so kind, the experiment would give us useful information, not just that it didn't work, but it would tell us key parameters about atomic behavior, so then the next generation could be designed better. And so we spent 5 years going through that.
How do you see it? How do you see the condensation? Do you literally see it, or is there a behavior?
Yeah, you literally see it. Well, we literally see it. I mean, we take a picture of it, and it's a shadow picture, but it really is
a
picture.
Visible.
Yeah. And so if you've got a little cloud of atoms and it's held in a magnetic field, like, which is what we have, and so it's this, you know, little blob of atoms. Atoms are flying around. It's kind of all spread out, a little round blob. When it goes into a condensate, it actually changes shape very dramatically and turns into really the shape of a quantum wave function. And so it's very much, you know, it looks like a very different shape. Instead of this kind of fuzzy round blob, it's this kind of sharp shark's fin looking thing.
Was there a moment then you saw this? And
yes. Yes, there was a very exciting moment. In fact, when I talk about this to general public audiences, I emphasize how we have these beautiful pictures, and part of the reason the pictures are beautiful is because I put a lot of work into making them look beautiful, but from a physics point of view, they were beautiful from the beginning, in that this showed up very dramatically, and this is very different from most experiments where, you know, it's the first signals or some very tiny, obscure sort of thing, and you keep working and working to enhance them. In this case,
it's not there, and then it's there.
And then we just, you know, turned on the app. You know, we'd been through all these generations of experiments, learning more and more and more, and we had an experiment which we now knew we knew enough to guarantee this, the cooling. We're trying to make this new cooling process work. We knew now we'd have the conditions for this new cooling process to work. And so what was going to happen when we got cold enough, that was still, you know, nature could have made it all disappear. But in fact, you know, we turned that on, cooled down far enough, and immediately there was then this very dramatic change. It wasn't a little tiny smudge that you work at. It was just there. So that was a lot more exciting.
Very exciting.
In fact, I wasn't there to see it. I was actually off at a review panel thing in Woods Hole, and I remember I'd have to sit and listen to these presentations, and between every presentation I'd run off and phone back to the lab to see what the latest things were. So
I guess a picture was taken immediately.
Right. We have detailed images. You know, and that's great. I can show, when I give the lecture, I'll be showing the original pictures, because they're still, you know, dramatic demonstration that it worked in the very first one.
After you did your original work on the Bose-Einstein condensate, how did you follow it up? Did you decide to try to use it in another context?
Yeah, in fact, the real incentive for this for us wasn't making it. I mean, although that would have been great. The real incentive, and frankly the reason we got a Nobel Prize so fast, was that it's not that it exists, it's such interesting stuff. It's this blob, you know, that's tiny, but, you know, almost human size scale, thickness of a hair, and it's totally quantum mechanical in its behavior, so very non-intuitive. Like, you put two blobs on top of each other, you know, these are two little blobs of gas, you put them on top of each other, and instead of seeing just a blob with more gas in it, like you always do in normal gas, it actually has fringes where it cancels out, first blob actually cancels out the existence of the other atoms in the other blob and enhances it in certain points. So it's, you know, they're behaving as quantum waves. Yeah, and so it really lets you really observe and manipulate things at the quantum wave function level. So we've been spending all time since then, you know, studying the properties of it, putting it under new conditions, new ways of looking at it, and learning more about it.
So can it be used as a tool for
applications, you mean?
Applications.
Well, so that's what... I mean, I'm not going in that direction. But yeah, in the last couple of years, you know, it's understood well enough, they've had enough time to sort of think about it, that in fact they are starting to look at applications. New certain kinds of super sensitive measurement instruments, using it. They're working on using it as a way to realize quantum computers, because in a quantum computer you need sort of a very specially crafted wave function, and if you're starting out with one that's a million times bigger than a normal wave function, that's always a good place to start. So yeah, I mean, there's starting to be work on that now.
Does the fact that this stuff does exist, has been made, does it have implications in other ways? Like, it could have been made under other conditions, non-tinkering conditions, any early universe, any sort of other?
Well, there's various talk things about that that relates to. I don't really think our work has had that much implication in it, other than kind of making people think in those directions a little bit. But where it has had implications is there's really just a lot of physics of many atoms that you can explore in different ways. And so, you know, there's people from nuclear physics who come in, you know, particularly theoretical work in this area. Lots of people from condensed matter physics, connecting it up with ideas in condensed matter physics. There's spin-offs of this, largely led by a young faculty member we hired at Gillette, Debbie Chin, who is getting lots and lots of attention because she's making these coupled fermion Bose condensations, which are really quite likely to help people understand the physics of high-temperature superconductivity. And so, you know, it is sort of branching out into different fields. But it's not in terms of understanding underlying physical laws. It's really understanding how those laws are manifested in the quantum, at the quantum level, when you have many particles interacting. There's, you know, in that complexity, there's a lot of new, unexpected things.
Well, I know aside from your physics work, you're very involved in the education end of physics and science.
Right. Yeah, so I've been interested in science education for a long time, but I made a fairly conscious decision after Bose-Einstein condensation really took off. You know, now I'm just one of a big industry again. and so, you know, it's interesting things to keep going there, but I really look to me like there are opportunities to make a bigger impact, much bigger impact in science education. So, like I say, this is an area that I've sort of always been interested in, but with a Nobel Prize and sort of after that thinking, okay, what do I want to do with my life? This seemed like a worthwhile thing. And it's also, I mean, a lot of people think it's very different. I actually look at it as not very different at all. And this is something that most physicists don't understand and most education people don't understand. But that, you know, the whole reason I got really thinking about education more than most people is I'm a very good experimentalist. I'm good at measuring things and thinking objectively, seeing what the experiment tells me and not being biased when it comes out. Yeah. And so in teaching, I've been looking and been pretty clear that students aren't learning very much. You know, I think I'm more inclined than most people to believe in measuring these things rather than just sort of assuming that
anecdotal,
this works because it always works, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, I'm picking the right time because people over the last several years, particularly in physics, but also other areas of science, are really starting to develop this field of science education research, or where they're really thinking about using research on how people's brains work, how people learn, and then developing much more meaningful ways to measure how students are learning. And that tells you then, when you find out how disastrous the current results are, it tells you ways, you know, gives you principles that you can use to develop new experiments, and you can see which ones they work. So for me, it's you know, it's just experimental science again. And you know, it's interesting to hear the objections from both sides that I have to deal with. So physicists say, well, you know, students, they're all too many unknowns. There are all these other factors. It's all soft, fuzzy stuff. You can't really measure things carefully. And educators largely say the same thing. I mean, they say, well, no, we have to use a whole different concept of research. But if you're doing things like I do, where you're really pushing the edge of science, you know, there's all kinds of things you can't control and understand nearly as well as you want to. And the whole trick of being a good scientist is figuring, okay, in spite of this, you know, how can I, what experiments can I design, what measurements can I make that, yeah, I know there's all these things I can't control as well as I'd like, but what can I do that the results can still be used to give me useful things that I can get clear conclusions out of? So I look at it pretty much the same, and the principle applies pretty much the same. So from that part, the research is kind of fun. It's this kind of like getting into atomic physics when you had one of the first tunable lasers. You've got this whole open area where it's relatively easy to do new, fairly major advances. And then I have a big advantage that, you know, there's this big divide between the folks who have been doing science education research and the science community, you know, the faculty who, you know, they teach, but their research is what makes their reputations. And so I can understand, I mean, at this point I've interacted enough, I've read enough papers on the education research that I can talk to both sides in a reasonable way and actually mediate a lot between them and some of the misunderstandings that they deal with.
Sounds like a real challenge, maybe harder than Bose-Einstein condensation in its way.
Well, you know, changing the whole system is harder, but making progress is easier. So
sort of have to banish the idea of absolutes, I guess, in a way. People want everything to be exact and absolute. You have to...
Yeah, but, you know, in real science, it's only long after it's old and boring and repeated dozens of times are things so absolute and, you know, clear.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.